Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, the podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. For nearly three decades, artist Renee Green has created an impressive body of work in which language is an essential element. Green is also a prolific writer and a major voice in the international art world. Other Planes of There, Selected Writings, gathers for the first time a substantial collection of the work she wrote between 1981 and 2010. The book brings together essays, film scripts, reviews, and polemics, as well as reflections on Green's own artistic practice and seminal artworks. In this program, recorded on March 1, 2015, Renee Green and James Meyer discuss the 30 years of contemporary art, incisive critiques, and prescient observations showcased in Other Planes of There. Their conversation spans cinema, literature, sound, time-based media, and the relationship between art forms and other forms of knowledge.
I am James Meyer, and I am a curator here at the National Gallery, and I want to welcome you all to this afternoon's event with Renee Green. Thank you so much for coming out in this horrible weather. So Renee Green is an artist I've had the pleasure to know, I'm afraid to say, since 1993. When Renee and I met, Renee kindly agreed to participate in my first group show, which was called What Happened to the Institutional Critique. At that point, Renee was already quite well known. She had already established quite a reputation at that point. Renee went to college at Wesleyan University. She took a course in publishing and book arts at Radcliffe. She attended the Whitney Independent Study Program, that very generative program for artists and critics, and she had a residency at the Studio Museum in Harlem, which many fine contemporary artists have been a part of. That led to a series of installations that were very significant, I think, in New York during the 90s, including one at PS1 and one at the Clock Tower. Installations that explored characters from history, including Josephine Baker and Sarah Bartman, the enslaved African woman who traveled around Europe in the early 19th century as a kind of display. Renee immediately starts to have major shows at places like the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA in 93, a show that was called World Tour, with four different installations by Renee that she had made elsewhere, presented in a kind of tour of her art and a tour, if you will, of, quote, the world, as you went from one installation and one period of history to another. She has had shows at Oberlin College, at the Museum of Contemporary Art, the Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, the Tapies Foundation in Barcelona, where she met her life partner, Javier Anguela, who collaborates with Renee on her projects, and Javier is here today. She had a fabulous show, which I was able to see in the Maritime Museum in Greenwich in England, up the River Thames, and I think we might see some of these works in Renee's talk. She recently had an installation at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, a series of pavilions that she designed. And she has participated as well in many of the important group shows around the world, the Whitney Biennial of 93, really the most important Whitney Biennial of recent times, the Venice Biennale, Documenta in Germany, the biennials in Johannesburg and Gwangju, Korea, Istanbul, the show Manifesta around that tours around Europe. She's been in all of these major exhibitions. And I forgot to mention her one-person shows at the Vienna Secession in Vienna, the Yerba Buena Art Center in San Francisco, and her last big retrospective at the Musée Cantonal de Beaux-Arts in Lausanne, Switzerland, which I went over to see. So I've been a great fan of Renee's work for years, and Renee's work has caused me to think in ways that is quite unusual for a contemporary artist. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a minute. I wanted to also speak to her career as a professor. In addition to making all this work, Renee has taught at four institutions. She has been a professor at the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna, at the University of California in Santa Barbara, at the San Francisco Art Institute, where she was dean of the grad school, And most recently, she's currently at MIT. She's been the director of the program in Art, Culture, and Technology, ACT. So that's her current post. How has Renee's work enlarged the way I see contemporary practice and in my own thinking? I would speak to questions of medium, subject matter, and form, those classic ways that we talk about a work of art. Medium, subject matter, and form. With regard to medium, Renee's work is not confined to any one medium. She has worked in most or perhaps every medium an artist could possibly work in. Sculpture, installation, photography, book art, sound, film, video, architecture, and even painting. She even made some paintings early on. So she's not bound by medium, not restricted by medium. Her work ascribes to itself a permission to work in all different kinds of media in order to get at the concerns that she needs to pursue. One of her media is, of course, the book, and she's made several books as part of her exhibitions. They're very interesting books in their own right. And Other Planes of There, the book that we're celebrating the publication of, is a sense a culmination of the writing strand of her art. So she works between media. There is no closure in terms of medium. What about subject matter? Renee's art is an art of planes. It's interesting that you called your book Other Planes of There, Renee. Other Planes, because when I think of your art, I think of your subject matters consisting as planes or layers, if you will, strands that surface in different works and come back in others. What are these planes? What are these layers? Well, Renee will tell us about them, but I would point out some that have fascinated me. One is the plane of history. Renee is an artist who's very interested in history and has made works about historical episodes in time. But at the same time, if history is necessity and it produces certain possibilities of culture, of history, of being. There's also in Renee's art chance. There's necessity of history, but there's chance. And chance, you never know when something will produce historical effects because of completely an arbitrary reason. So history and chance have an interesting role to play in Renee's art. Identity. Identity has always been a theme of Renee's art. In terms of gender and race and every possible identity. But for Renee, identity is not fixed. It is not singular. It is historical. It changes over time. And it occurs in a kind of transaction in history with other, a kind of meeting of identities, people crossing each other in particular moments of time. She's made a piece that she might show us called Import-Export Funk Office, where you had on one hand the European philosopher Theodore Adorno and the other the American philosopher and activist Angela Davis kind of crossing in the same work. So identity is negotiated in Renee's work. It happens in a kind of transit as people, in a sense, cross each other in paths. And there have been many figures or avatars in Renee's work. I mentioned Josephine Baker. I mentioned Sarah Bartman, Adorno, Angela Davis. She's made works about Teddy Roosevelt and Robert Smithson, the great American artist Robert Smithson, and the Korean writer Teresa Chak. Many different figures sort of surface and embed the history, give it a kind of specificity around a particular historical figure. But they're not always historical. There are fictional figures in Renee's art, characters that she has invented. She's written a novel called Camino Road. And even in a work where she starts to think about her own self, a work like Partially Buried, which we might see today, Renee herself enters the work. The artist comes into the work, but she is often described as a she. She herself becomes a persona, a figure in her art. Travel, mobility, is a major theme in René's work. Many of these works, the figures are travelers. They move from place to place, and the identities occur in, as I said, transit, as people pass one another. Desire. There's a psychological dimension to René's art, and it's often desire, the desire of the traveler, the desire of the reader. Fantasy, a whole plane of what do I expect to occur when I travel to this place? Who will I meet? What do I think of when I imagine another place? Desire, fantasy. That's another plane in René's art. There's a psychological plane, I'm saying. There's also an economic plane. Some of her works have explored class, property, finances. A work she might show to us today, Bequest, at the Worcester Art Museum, was about a particular family whose fortune founded the Worcester Art Museum, the Salisbury family, and their property she showed in the exhibition itself. So there are many different layers or planes in René's art. There's always a plane that's leading to another. Her art is inexhaustible. It doesn't stop. It is open, and that's the question of form, the third issue I mentioned, form, René's form. Her form is open. It's not constricted. One form can change. One installation can change. If you move it to another institution, another place, the forms may change a little bit. Form in René's art is also open. So if there's an enemy in René Greene's art, it's closure. It's the shutting down of meaning, the shutting down of imagination, the shutting down of possibility. Her work is an invitation to think, to explore, and to imagine. Her ethics are the ethics of a kind of openness, of meaning and form and media. So that's a brief and extemporaneous few thoughts about René Greene's art, and why it has compelled me as a viewer for really over more than 20 years. So this is René's first visit to a museum in Washington, and we're terribly thrilled and honored, René, that you've come. And we're so looking forward to hearing about your work now. And then afterwards, René and I will talk, and of course, you'll hopefully talk with us. So René Greene.
Well, I have to say that was an amazing introduction, and thank you so much, James, for inviting me here. It's exciting to be here at last. And what I'm going to do, because the focus of this presentation is really on the book and what's been generated from the writings in the book. And so what I'm going to do is follow up, in a way, with what I did not know that James was going to say, which was amazing. I have a presentation of images. And I'm not going to describe to you what is in each of the images. It would take much too long to do something like that. What I'm going to do is give you more of an impressionistic view of works that were produced between the time period that James alluded to, and I'm going to read passages from the introduction of the book. And I will then come back to, I will also show you a few excerpts of films in addition. So let's see how this goes, because I haven't done it before. This is the first time that I'm actually going to be doing a reading from the book, because it's pretty recent, and I wanted to test this approach on you and see how it goes. So, and as the introduction that I wrote is fairly long, I'm going to take paragraphs here and there from it, and I'll just start reading. The title of the introduction is Other Planes, Different Phases, My Geometry, Times, Movements. When I look at the many shelves of books in my library and focus on the section of books and catalogs in which my work resides, the titles and covers all look interesting in their own way, yet I continue to search. I don't find what I'm looking for. It hasn't been made yet. It hasn't been made. Yet I can imagine something other than what I'm finding. I return to the manuscript of this book you now read. I think about the vast breadth and varying depths of the events and encounters throughout my life as an artist and as a writer as I select what to give you at this time. I don't think of this as the definitive book of my work, as I'm still alive, writing and working, wondering as I wander. Yet there are some combinations in words I'd like you to be able to read, which I haven't yet read elsewhere. For that reason, I feel compelled to give you these words. There are many years, dates, and addresses inscribed in my filled notebooks, my most consistent companions on all of my travels along with my journals, which differ in function, a source to which I return, part of a working process, a reference to what I've made and written. The notebooks contain a running internal dialogue in relation to my work as an artist with what is encountered in the world, questions, reflections, ideas, and indications of works and transmutations to come. As a prelude to other planes of there, I offer these recent transmuted excerpts as one way of telling a story. For example, other planes, different phases, my geometry, times, movements, becomings ongoing. Fluidity and architecture, time flow, change acceptance as its condition, space variation, as in music, movable parts or units or notes, sounds composed plus improvised. I like architecture because there is in it the knowledge of building something up as well as tearing something down, quite literally. This is its history and its practice. Ruins may be romantic fragments that archaeologists and poets can mine to learn about past humans. Living architecture means an acceptance of ruin to come. This differs from the historic notion of art as matter made timeless, meant to last, an illusory wish, yet this somehow persists. We see the persistence of this wish at art auctions, a wish that art and money could mean something real and permanent rather than speculative, illusory, and fleeting. But with architecture and art, as with music, there is a plan, drawings, a score, based on what was designed or composed, something that can be reanimated by someone else at another time in another space, passed on to the living. One dream of conceptual art, at least that of Solowitz. When reading particularly about art, sometimes it seems that the 20th century ended in the 1960s, in terms of any hopes and dreams. Afterward, everything that followed became post or neo. Strange to be born in and grow up in a time that appears to be an extension of something perceived to have been authentic. If one carefully reads what was published during the years, even from one's birth to the present, what can be discovered can astonish, as well as satisfy nagging curiosity temporarily. The aha effect, speculative puzzle parts click into place for a moment. The story I have to tell is an artist's story. This becomes the story of many people through time. It is a growing seed. I go deeper into the works and words of artists. After art, Steve Lacy, for example, Chris Marker, for example, yes, both born in the 20th century, living into the 21st century, and both now physically dead, yet the works amaze still. And me, having lived 40 years in what was called the 20th century and having also lived 12 more in what is called the 21st century, Who determines what anything is called or designated in the present? What is this clutching onto memories about? Following the path of one's changing thoughts and works through the traces, the writings as well as the returns, and deeper and further explorations and ripenings, oneself as another through time. We do so many things now with our little portable computer interfaces, from FaceTime conversations between Prague and Somerville, to making little movies, printing texts and images, texting across the room during dull lectures, presentations, or meetings, occasionally with images. We can do many things, yet we can't break the screen distance barriers. We can use additional lenses and microphones to create higher definition representations. We can transmit, yet this is not the same as touching a person or a distant place or thing. Our kisses remain on the tiny screen, leaving blurry marks. No skin contact, no videodrome yet. To be American plus artist in different centuries and decades and years, issues, wishes, acts, a search, the making of Americans, Stein, a realization or realizations, the recognitions, Gaddis, Morrison's complete oeuvre, going beyond or exceeding excess, newness, oldness, and everything in between, Portugal, Pocahontas, pilgrims, pioneers, pirates, pyrotechnics, Pyrrhic victories. To articulate this complexity, plus to simplify, to concentrate, to compress, to code, to compose in a form. Discovering the recent past, that is, what is designated as the 20th century, designations, assignations, for example, the Anthropocene, according to, compared to, what? Yes, precedents, but again, according to, compared to, what? Or, incomparable, beyond category. There is a discourse about the arts, rarely written and at times unspoken, which is neither that of historians so deeply tied to time and space, nor that of critics concentrating on personal views about the arts or on contemporary judgments about whatever it is that they see. It is the discourse of sensibilities affected by the excitement of visual impressions. It is the discourse of love. Rereading Ellison, Yardbird Reader, Volume 5, Lewis Hyde, Jimmy Durham, Michael Doris. Revisiting, rereading, rethinking, encountering freshly. After having lived in Mexico, Europe, and California, after having lived 30 years more since first encountering their words, after having lived through various demarcations of time, after having lived through times during which events happened, now living through times that continually reverberate with the residue of past events, even if these are forgotten rapidly and selectively remembered or commemorated, which is the way of humans, it seems, both newness and oldness being claims made by someone. Although I always paid rent in New York and exhibited in the United States from 1991 to 2003, I worked primarily outside the States. I supported myself touring, or the artist equivalent of such, working with galleries and with curators on every continent, something that became possible differently in the 1990s with the global capital spreads, the changing forms of circulation, and ways of imagining access in contrast to the former age of three worlds, designated as having ended in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall and communism. In 2003, I moved to Santa Barbara, California, after having lived and worked in Vienna since 1997. The U.S. war with Iraq began in March 2003. A right-wing politician elected in Austria came into office in 2000. The World Trade Center in New York was hit in 2001. Perceptions of any nation, as well as how to be an artist, were in a state of flux, which preceded that moment which hasn't abated. These writings, gathered in other planes of there, reflect one person's encounters during many shifts. Afters, ongoing becomings. Questions. What will be saved, retained, transmuted, retained, recognized, understood, recognized? What happens to artists in the United States depending on where they are from? The elaborate genealogy constructed, dismissed, or ignored, and how they circulate in the Americas and elsewhere in the world. Many interesting cases, formations of many combinations and combination people. After a 1995 conference held in London at the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Art, and co-sponsored by Innova, Mirage, Enigmas of Race, Difference in Desire, I decided I wanted to radically shift the focus of how I was working and how the work could be perceived. It became evident to me that I needed to focus more specifically on time-based media, as well as on different forms of diffusion, placement, and contact. I'd been working with these forms previously, but I'd initiated this shift for myself in 1994 with the invention of free agent media, which I launched with the publication of my novel and video, Camino Road, in Madrid and at the Museo Reina Sofia. I'd already produced works using video and sound, and I wanted to push this further into filmmaking in digital modes. There were several reasons. My visceral reactions to ways of being positioned was a definite indication to me that I needed to find a way of working more suitable to the varied dimensions of creation I wanted to express. As language and sound have always been aspects of my ways of thinking and creating, as is indicated in many of the discrete works I've made, I wanted to be able to animate in a simultaneous yet contrapuntal layered way, visually and aurally, to bring the parts together into one form. I also found it irritating to keep speaking to a public on panels. I wanted to be able to show a clip of a film, something that had already been thought and formed, with images and sound and movement. I needed to shift, and I did. I wanted to create in a form that others could respond to without needing an intermediary, a popular form that could also be erudite, containing worlds with kaleidoscopic potential, a form that didn't require a docent. The tour was contained within the form itself, if a tour was desired, each percipient following their own mental path, with its myriad associations while encountering a composed form in a space, whether on a tiny screen or projected in labyrinthine rooms. Ooh, it worked. So now what I'd like to do is show you a couple of excerpts from a film. It's called Endless Dreams and Water Between. And it was produced in conjunction with an exhibition by the same title. James alluded to this work. It was at the National Maritime Museum in England in Greenwich in 2009. So I'm just going to show you some brief excerpts, and then I'll come back. It's about 8 minutes.
Here are some initial thoughts I've written regarding the September Institute. These are up for discussion, so I look forward to your feedback. I listed four mottos. One, we still own our words and can produce them. Two, anything you create, you want to exist, and its means of existence is in being printed. Three, sending transmissions from dispersed islands, linking worlds, time, and space. Four, we continue the ongoing movement of combination people. September Institute, compiles and regenerates material from abandoned collections and publications, providing indexical access and linked research tools that enable circulation within the depths of significant ideas, operations, and productions of those who may have been forcefully forgotten. SI publishes out-of-print books to give them new life. September Institute is not a utopian community, but rather a momentary nexus. It exists in contrast to previous idealist attempts to address shifting contemporary moments. Acknowledging the predilections of the past, idealist, romantic, utopian, and modernist aims, SI embraces the present, however it is calibrated, in relation to time with a consciousness of time's expanse. Beautiful and odd remnants from the expanse of time are excavated, represented, and rethought. These include books, ephemera, notebooks, photos, and out-of-date, time-based formats, i.e. pre-digital. They are evidence of encounters, a trace of experience. SI produces books of collected data. Online versions also exist. Please let's continue thinking and exchanging. I love words, etymologically, textually. It's possible to enter words on one's own, as each of us can enter the letters we've exchanged on our own. Examining each other's thoughts separately, this process of exchanging and learning about each other's thoughts through letters is a bit like learning about words. Becoming familiar with the vast range of nuances possible of words and thoughts is like entering a secret or monastic order. Very few people care about words or thoughts in this way. It's the way things are. I find comfort in this exploration, though, perhaps because it's specialized rather than standardized knowledge, which is so abundant. How to translate past feelings, times, and histories into meaningful comprehension that can provide fuel amidst present feelings of lack and absence. Was it always this way? I wonder about life before our presumed extreme technological connectivity and presumed availability. I wonder how you feel and how others have felt. Probing these things has motivated this correspondence. The wish for something else that might be possible, more profound understanding, for example, other kinds of meaning. I do care about depth and varieties of meanings, as I care about combinations and permutations, as we've discussed. Autodidacticism can be extremely fulfilling, especially when so much can appear to be a wasteland. This doesn't mean that I'm interested in retreating, but rather I feel my senses available to engage are sharpened as I can choose a more exact way of articulating or conveying them in words, images, sounds, etc. I respect and admire each of you for also sharing these interests. Since so many specialized skills, things, and people are slipping into oblivion, my interest is more and more in what is specific and perhaps thought of as esoteric. What is determinedly unfashionable, this interests me. Maybe some things are too difficult to reproduce because there is no facility, concentration, or interest that enables easy reproduction. I'm not endorsing craft, as it's recently been labeled. This is not my interest. I'm also not suggesting difficulty for the sake of difficulty, nor am I assuming that specialty can be equated with superiority. Yet still, I wish to probe life's complexity. And I'm glad that each of you is also willing to do this. I'll conclude my letter with something to ponder as it relates to what I've written. We can wander with Henri Bergson and Gilles Deleuze. Why something rather than nothing? But why this rather than something else? Why this tension of duration? Why this speed rather than another? Why this proportion? And why will a perception evoke a given memory or pick up certain frequencies rather than others? In other words, being is difference and not the immovable or the undifferentiated, nor is it contradiction which is merely false movement. Being is the difference itself of the thing, what Bergson often calls the nuance. I'll leave you with those words until the next time. From each of our islands, let's stare at the moon. Yours, Aria.
So to conclude my part of the presentation, I'd like to just show a few images from a current exhibition. It's on now in Los Angeles at the Schindler House, and it's continuing until the end of March. And I'm going to show you a part of a film that's in progress. It's in four stanzas, and the first one is what I'm going to show you today, and it's an experiment in the sense of experimenting with what's possible in an exhibition context, and also with the time-based media within this kind of context, and the duration of the exhibition itself, and the challenge I'm giving myself within certain constraints to finish this film. Before the exhibition is concluding. And so part of it is there now as part of this installation. This is an image from it, and along with four other films that are referencing California in some way. I'm not going to give you all the details of what it is, but the name of the exhibition is Begin Again, Begin Again, and that's also the name of the film part I'm going to show you. And so this will be the end of my part presentation. The part that you're going to see is about 12 minutes, and then we're going to have our conversation. Thank you.
Begin again, begin again, begin again, begin again. Begin again, 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 begin again. Begin again, 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 begin again. Begin again, 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 begin again. What was life? No one knew. It was undoubtedly aware of itself, so soon as it was life. But it did not know what it was. It was not matter, and it was not spirit, but something between the two, a phenomenon conveyed by matter. Like the rainbow on the waterfall, and like the flame. Yet why not material? It was sentient to the point of desire, disgust. The shamelessness of matter becomes sensible of itself. The incontinent form of being. It was a secret and ardent stirring in the frozen chastity of the universal. It was a stolen and voluptuous impurity of sucking and secreting. an exhalation of carbonic gas and material impurities of mysterious origin and compositions. Modern Architecture, a Program, Vienna, 1912, R.M. Schindler. Stanza 1. 1. The cave was the original dwelling. 2. A hollow adobe pile was the first permanent house. 3. To build meant to gather and mass material, allowing it to form. 4. Empty cells for human shelter. 5. This conception provides the basis for understanding all styles. 6. Of architecture up to the 20th century. 7. The aim of all architectural effort was the conquest of structural. 8. Bulk by man's will for expressive form. At first, there was mud and the sound of breathing, and no one was sure of where we were. When we found out, it was much too late. Now, nothing can happen safe as it has to happen. And then, I was alone, and it did not matter. Only because by that time, nothing could matter. September 10th, Vienna. 1888. 1889. 1890. 1891. 1892. 1893. 1894. 1895. 1896. 1897. 1898, 1899, 1900, 1901, 1902, 1903, 1904, 1905, 1906, 1907, 1908, 1909, 1910, 1911, 1912, 1913. 9. All architectural ideas were conditioned by the use of a plastic. 10. Structural mass material. 11. The technique of architect and sculpture were similar. 12. The vault was not the result of a room concept, but of a 13. Structural system of piling masonry to support the mass enclosure. 14. The decoration of walls was intended to give the structural. 15. Mass a plastic face. 16. These old problems have been solved and the styles are dead. The next year, there were knifing matches in the stadium. I think the people were ready for it, the mayor said. Total involvement. A new concept of sports. The loser does not leave the ring alive. Seventeen. Our efficient way of using materials eliminated the plastic. 18. Structural mass. 19. The contemporary architect conceives the room and forms it with 20 ceiling and wall slabs. 21. The architectural design concerns itself with space as its raw 22 material, and with the articulated room as its product. But no one can know where he is until he knows where he has been. I sat quietly, and the air changed then. And I looked up, and the black branches trailing in the living water stirred slowly with the change of air.
Piropos,
you said.
El aire les hace piropos.
Because of the lack of a plastic mass, the shape of the inner room, 24, defines the exterior of the building. Therefore, the early, 25, primitive product of this new development is the box-shaped, 26, house. Have you changed for this banknote? It is closed off for the time being. Take me to the other end of the city, where they slice up the sharks on the sand. The double tariff applies after sundown. It is forbidden to pass beyond this railing. Take me to the other end of the city, where nobody wants to go. '1914, '1915, '1916, '1917, '1918, '1919. Yes, I said we would need the machine guns by next March, but I also warned against saying life was easy. I mixed hoops and coffins, cradles and needles, while the light twinkled on, far off Manto Tomas. We sat in a park that smelled of pine trees, and that night there were voices in the corridors, and I remembered the empty face of the blind man as he sang.
Tú misma tienes la culpa de lo que has hecho conmigo.
You will find yourself among people. 27. The architect has finally discovered the medium of his art. 28. Space. 29. A new architectural problem has been born. 30. Its infancy is being shielded as always by emphasizing functional. 31. Advantages. There's no help for this, nor should you want it otherwise. The passages where no one waits are dark and hard to navigate. The wet walls touch your shoulder on each side, and now they are gone. Does it matter? The passages where no one waits go on and give no promise of an end. You will find yourself among people and words and many words. Where there was life, I said that life was wrong. What do I say now? You understand? '1920, '1921, '1922, '1923, '1924, '1925, '1926, '1927, '1928, '1929.
Renee, I was going to ask you who that wonderful narrator is, but it's your brother, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Derek Green.
Yeah, the one and only.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful film. I'm wondering if we could just, because you've shown us very generously so many projects, but very much in passing, I'm wondering if we could sink our teeth into one of them, just going back and just talk about one or two of them. so that we have a clear sort of grasp of how you work, how you put these things together. And then I'd like to come forward to the Schindler Project and to think about how your work has developed or changed and how it's consistent from one moment, or from the 20 years ago to this. I was thinking it might be interested to look at the Toile de Jouy and at the Bequest projects. What do you think about those?
Okay. Just in terms of recalling them, things that you've seen?
Yes, and thinking about how, because I think the Toile de Jouy really shows how a project can change in different iterations. Mm-hmm. And I think that Bequest, for example, introduces really how language is functioning in your work. But of course, the Clock Tower, any of those early projects, have language. So the question of how you're using language, it's interesting, I think, to look at some of those projects, to think about, is everything an appropriated text? Did you write the text?
Okay.
Is it your voice? Is it another voice? Does that sound congenial?
Sure, that's fine. I mean, it's complicated in the sense that, I guess, just to explain about the framework of this presentation.
Yes.
What I was thinking about was that within the book, mm-hmm. Everything is referenced in the book except this most recent project. Mm-hmm. And so from images to actual texts, and it's not in a linear fashion because there's a section called operations, and in that it's kind of describing in different kinds of ways the enactment of making different of those mm-hmm. works. And it's not just a description, but more documents that came about in the mm-hmm. process of making the works. But for me, to think back on the Toile, that work, I'm not exactly sure what you would like us to talk about in terms of that.
I think how it mm-hmm. came about and how it changed mm-hmm. and how, I mean, there was, some of the pictures were just of one installation. But
oh, okay, but, yeah. The various kinds of iterations of the ways
yes.
I had used the toile,
yeah.
which is fabric and wallpaper,
yeah.
Whether it was furniture or whether it was like a suit.
Yeah,
it was used in part in a performance also with the gallerist, Pat Hearn, wore the suit.
Yeah.
For the duration of the show.
Could we put up those pictures of the Toile de Jouy? Because I think didn't it start off at the fabric workshop?
It began in Philadelphia, workshop.
In terms of your relationship to medium, I had forgotten to mention fabric and furniture. That you've even worked.
Now, I've worked with all kinds of, any kind of material that's designed, anything that's made. I mean, that's part of the investigation. And so even now at MIT, for example, being within the School of Architecture and Planning, I have access to all kinds of forms of fabrication, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to work there. And Joan Jonas, who was sort of came before, indicated some of those possibilities of what we can do mm-hmm. with, and so I'm interested, and I was then, and continue to be in all kinds of ways of production, like how something might be made, and so yes, the fabric that was a specific one. And also changing the meaning of what a traditional form might reflect. And so, it was made in 1991, and I must say it was probably one of the earlier iterations of fabric that was used in this way, changing the meaning of this pastoral kind of image. From France. I mean, partly this work also grew out of work that I was doing in France, in Clisson, and it was in the region where some of these fabrics had been produced in the 18th century. So, but there's a whole. I have written a lot about it, and
part of it is in the book also. Mm. It's called Collecting Well is the Best Revenge. Mm. That's one of the essays, which has been republished in different other places. But yeah, the Toile it's been very popular, I think, because people recognize it in some kind of way. And so, yeah, it appeared in New York Times, Sunday Magazine, as a fashion page. It means all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's a conceptual piece, mm-hmm. but it's very visual mm-hmm. and physical, because then you would give it different platforms. You would put it on historical furniture. You could make it into walls, paper.
I did a lot of things with it. It was in Aperto in Venice, Biennale. And then in that instance, I covered it up with plastic. And mm-hmm. I mean, I did a lot of different things with it, because it's something that appeared to be widely recognizable and having different kinds of meanings for different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we think of it as this very, as you said, pastoral and elegant and tasteful fabric. Mm-hmm. And what you've done, didn't you find some of these horrible images in books?
I used contemporary images, but some of those were from Haiti, images that were like from engravings that were produced at that time during the Haitian independence. I mixed different ones. Different other kinds of images that were of the same time period that the original ones were used. And so that kind of brought in another dimension of history that was taking place at the same time.
Yeah, and there are also images of romance, of a kind of heterosexual romance, these mm-hmm. couples, mm-hmm. and then you intersperse these other images. And But you made it at the workshop, and then it could migrate to Clisson, that town in France, and you were asked to do an installation there.
Well, actually, that came before. I was still in process of making the fabric, and so I believe, actually, the fabric that I made was never there. I had found other fabric that was similar, and while I was there, I was talking with people, historians locally, who were familiar with the history of the fabric. Mm-hmm. And so then I was able to produce it and then show it in New York, Pat Hearn Gallery, and mm-hmm. also at MoCA as part of that exhibition there, the World Tour Show.
And wasn't Clisson a town whose wealth had been developed out of the slave trade?
Well, it was very close to Nantes,
yes.
And it was also not very far from Bordeaux. And at the time, nobody was really interested in that field of investigation. I was very interested in all of the beauty. All of the beautiful things that were produced there, and the botanical gardens, and I was also interested in Jules Verne and the kinds of atmosphere of the place. But part of what kept disrupting it for me was finding these different traces on building facades and things like that that had reference to slavery in some kind. Even restaurants called L'Esclave, for example, that was one of the things I had seen. I was interested in it, and I learned more from an urbanist who was knowledgeable about the history of the region, and also about, there was an island there, and also Bordeaux and the trade with wine. But this is kind of, these are all in relationship to each other. And so I guess this was around 1991. Mm-hmm. And then I think a couple of years later, there was an article in the New York Times that described that trade, historically. Mm. Yeah.
And then if we could go back to the image of Nagel, when you start to put them into an art gallery.
Oh, okay. So this is in a gallery, Metropole.
And
this is in Vienna. This was, it was produced, must have been, this was like 92, 93, around that time. 92. And so this is in a location, it's actually the street is Dorotheergasse, which mm-hmm. is in Vienna, which is really close to where the auction houses are in Vienna.
I see.
And so this gallery used to primarily deal with antiques. And when different people who were familiar with them, before they had moved into contemporary art, were very excited to see this show through the windows, and they were happy because they thought they'd returned to something that they had been known for before, until they got a closer look and went into the gallery.
What the hell is going on?
Yeah, but Mozart music and these yeah. things were playing. You know, there were kinds of different things that made them feel differently.
so what I'm yeah. interested in, mm. in is the way the forms sort of shift mm. for mm-hmm. a different venue yep. and a different context.
Definitely, yeah.
And mm-hmm. Can bring in new meanings, because
right.
now we're in an antique row, mm-hmm. and you also show these, as you said, at Pat Hearn's, in a contemporary
right.
art gallery,
right.
which is selling, mm-hmm. you know, commodity mm-hmm. art, and that the same mm-hmm. kind of fabric can really shift in terms
yeah.
of what it's concerned with,
or right.
in the
yeah.
way you're displaying it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a kind of ongoing investigation in terms of the forms, and also reception of various forms in different places. Mm. And so that goes for, I mean, this is an image from in Amsterdam at the mm. Apple Foundation. I mean, it's been shown in a lot of different mm. situations and places, and had various kinds of forms of reception.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's something that I'm curious about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I meant when I was saying your work is not closed. I mean, mm-hmm. just you come up with this great idea, but then it's not going to just have one iteration. It can have other possibilities.
No,
other,
I think
other becomings.
Right,
to use one
right.
of your
the
words.
Like ongoing becomings. Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of what makes it also kind of frustrating to pin down. It's difficult. I think in many times, you know, it's not easy, because you can. It's open to various forms of interpretation, or some things that are also they appear to be paradoxical or contradictory or things like that, which is one of the aspects that it does intrigue me. I'm interested in where are those tensions? Where are they coming? You know, what makes them happen?
Mm. Mm. I just would like to look at one of the early language pieces.
Sure.
Because language is such an important aspect of your work, and the films you're just showing us that are new.
Mm-hmm.
Any of those early language pieces that you'd... I mean, I love Bequest, but is there...
Okay.
Or there's Import-Export, there's... Mm-hmm. Well, here we're very
we're
early.
Yeah. Many words. Yeah, this is one from Sites of Genealogy. This was originally at PS1 mm. in the attic. This was before... when PS1 was going through this sort of transition before they became the museum with MoMA, they had different spaces that were sort of abandoned, and this was in the attic space. And I was interested in using all of the spaces that were kind of evacuated, like the attic, the mm-hmm. cellar, and also
the
stairway.
Is that where the string is?
Yeah.
That
is there, yeah. And so that was very much involved with writing and words, mm. And so what you can see here is, and also the string was a kind of like a timekeeping device, in a way, kind of measuring the length of each of my visits when I'd go there and sit and write using this old technology, manual typewriter, and also paper, a stack of paper, which is kind of indicating a kind of ambition, and then the little stack, which were the actual filled pages. and so the idea that I would have like a vast amount of time to be able to fill these pages, be in the space. And I basically kind of squatted that space in the museum, because it was for about a year use the space.
So it changed? Did the
yeah,
insulation
over,
change?
Yeah, it just became denser and so mm. more of a wall of string.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a very word-related piece. Mm-hmm. And then also the text, it's like rubber-stamped type or words from instance in the life of a slave.
Can we look at some of the words?
Yeah, and so there are excerpts from those, really like the chapters and also the description of the attic in that
Harriet
narrative.
Jacobs?
That's Harriet Jacobs.
Her narrative of what she lived in an attic, right?
Right, but it's written. But it's written in this kind of like a 19th century romance, romantic form. So yeah, this sort of interspersed with the space. Yeah.
So it was her words.
Those words in that case, yeah, there were her words that were rubber stamped. And there were my words that were typed.
Huh.
And so and that's also, you know, sort of like also trying to create some kind of conversation with something that already exists and then thinking about it in the present. Like, how might it be different? What else could be thought about it at another time, in another space? Mm. And so that's part of what was emerging in the text. Actually, some are in the book. There's some... some parts of that are in the book.
All right.
Yeah.
and in Bequest, I seem to remember the texts were they from New England literature? You're at the Worcester Art Museum,
right, where
I'm from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So I've always liked this piece, and and so sort of these New England kind of white slat little miniature houses, if you will, and we're already seeing your interest in architecture really from the beginning. The attic is, is architecture.
And yeah, and this was like as if you were slicing clapboard parts of a house as well as, using this other kind of wooden structures.
And the texts were from
combination of sources.
Melville and... so,
well, this one, this is from one of those kind of guidance books, like A to Z, sort of like a kind of common prayer sort of book.
All right.
With the alphabet used, and it, like a kind of memory device for children. and then there are also like references to like quotations from W.E.B. Du Bois, from Melville, from Hawthorne. So it was very New England related work.
And weren't some of the texts about color? I mean, that are
they were in the set. I mean, the ways that those authors referred to them. So
the white whale,
right? About the whale, and so like also kind of inversion of a kind of usual meaning, but from those different authors, what they had written about the
that
terror.
They were complicating languages. Yeah. I mean,
they themselves were complicating
that
it.
In these great works of literature that language and color and are being complicated.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but then there was the dimension of the those portraits of the family
of the collection.
A bit of an institutional critique aspect to this, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this work was from 1991, and what the images that you're looking at are kind of mixed between two versions of it. There was one that was made for Worcester, and so and used works in the collection. So the portraits of the Salisbury family, each generation of them, and that was a death mask of the youngest of the Salisbury family. And these are images from the paintings that were in the collection. Mm. So there was a combination of sources. So this was from around 1991. This was 1991.
Yeah, very, very kind of early and groundbreaking work. So language has always been part of the work. And one other dimension, of course, is sound.
Yeah.
And your embrace of sound, your addition of sound to your, to your practice, and often the sound
since
is something.
Since the beginning, really, because actually I didn't mention in that work with the string, there's sound in that work, and it's a sound of water, sound of, and it's sort of like a very strong sound that's coming through, and continuous, looped sound.
And there's sounds of speakers too.
In other works.
In other works to come.
Oh yeah.
And that
the
language will take on a sonic or oral embodiment. It's, you know, it's the work in a sense becomes more visual and more and also more oral. It's almost like you're I don't know what you would if you would agree with me, but it's almost like you're upping the ante as you develop as an artist. in terms of more to see and more to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of related to what I was reading also about considering what it is you're trying to convey, as well as experimenting with the forms and testing them in different ways and experimenting with what you can take away and what you can leave and what kind of combination to put these different things together in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so now the Schindler, if we can look at the Schindler piece, the very new piece.
Okay.
which is a huge leap, and there's all sorts of fascinating things on the way, but for sake of time, so that film, right. And there's the house.
Yeah,
and
there's then, the house.
And there's fabric in the house, of course. You
right.
start to use the fabric. I remember in the Maritime Museum show that these banners, the fabric continues.
Right, and so those have a designation. What I call those are space poems. And there are space poems, and so this is the space poem number 5. And I started to make them in 2007, actually. And so what you had seen in the National Maritime Museum, that was space poem number 2, Laura's words. And they were in that case, they were the words of Laura Riding Jackson.
She's one of your characters, or
indirectly, in relationship to thinking about Majorca and Robert Graves. She was married to Robert Graves.
Oh, so she's a real person.
She was a real person, but she's kind of like a character. I mean, she was a character, but
a character in your art.
Yeah, I make her into a character.
Well, it's interesting how real people can become characters in the work.
Oh, yeah.
As much as the fictional people.
Yeah, or at least from their names, and then taking it from there, whatever happens will happen in a different kind of way. But in that instance, they were her actual words from a particular poem. She'd actually given up poetry. As a stance, as a writer. She wrote a whole treatise about giving up poetry. She was a modernist writer and poet. But in this case, in the Schindler House, this poem, it also has a poetic reference, in this case to Muriel Rukeyser, another poet who I've been working with her work for a while. Actually, the sound that you heard when this presentation began, the sort of whispering sound that was in the audience, sort of circulating, was from another work called Muriel's Words. And I mean, in both instances, these are poets whose work has kind of been sidestepped in a way. I mean, it's kind of being reclaimed now and has been, for the past 20 years, starting to be reclaimed. But there's a huge amount of work that it just probably has gone unread. And so I wanted to hear the sounds of some of those words. And in this instance, after was a very big part of thinking about begin again. And so all of the poems that Rukeyser wrote that had after in the first line, I used those in this space poem.
And so the film that we saw, that is... You're making that film. Is that screened in the Schindler House?
Yeah. One of the images that I showed you, this one, the projected image is that film.
And so that film was very rich, and it's looking back to Austria. The piece is co-commissioned by Mach, the Museum of
Angewandte Kunst.
Right, and Schindler was Viennese.
Right, and he never returned to Austria when he left to go to the United States. He left in 1914, but he left in June of 1914, and then World War I began later during that year. And so he completely missed that as a person in Europe, and he was in Los Angeles. Well, he went first to Chicago. He worked with Frank Lloyd Wright, and then he eventually went to Los Angeles, also working for Wright, and then making his house, which is this house, Schindler House. And the house itself was a kind of manifesto. And so what you're hearing with those numbered phrases are his manifesto, which was written in 1912 when he was still in Vienna before he ever come to the United States.
And then there's this. I love the way we're counting the years, and so there's actual history, but it's also how is history marked? We give these numbers, these dates to time, and we divide time according to these conventions, these linguistic conventions of dates. Mm-hmm. And what is our fantasy of the time? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's going on here.
That's going on.
That's so Renee to think, you know, how do I imagine, what does 1914 mean?
Yeah, what would it be? And also if I imagine it in relationship to some things that are also archival, material that come from Austria, how might this be put together, you know, based on having some knowledge of the place, and also imagining Schindler, more his subjectivity, and trying to think about what that might yield, you know. And so the years adding up, that's the part of this work. And also this idea of beginning again, coming to the United States, America, you know, has this new slate for someone from Europe.
Was he a Jewish refugee from the Nazis, or
he came earlier, and so he was not a refugee. He had come earlier, as did Richard Neutra, who came after having been in World War I, and both of them were living in this house, actually. Mm. The house was a sort of experiment in communal living. Mm.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't help but think, I mean, you were a professor in Vienna, and that, and you've done a whole exhibition at the Secession, that in a way this piece is, somehow your history is a thread in
it
this
is.
Too.
I mean, this piece will go on until 2015. That will be the constraint. The constraints are the birth date of Schindler, 1878, and then it ends in 2015. And Schindler went to the place where I was a professor. He was a student there in architecture, and also the Technical University. So a number of the locations also are very familiar to me also there. But it's an interesting thing to think about someone not going back, never going back to the place that they were born. Mm. And it was not necessarily even that he could not go back, but in some sense, yes. He was not. Mm. He didn't want. Mm. He didn't want to go back.
Mm. One of the things I like about your films is the way there's always this alternation, or often an alternation, between a present set of images and an archival set of images, all those images of Vienna and Austria that you found, those archival images, but yet compared with more contemporary, but what are the contemporary images? You know, they're very suggestive. Mm-hmm. But there are these two planes of time, if you will, or at least two planes in that piece.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, in this case, it's very much about architecture as well, like to really reflect on it and think about, well, what's the intensity connected to architecture and to inhabitation, or from the perspective of a practitioner? But also, where does that cross in terms of an aesthetic sensibility? So, I mean, those are kinds of things that I was I was interested in. But also, like, how do you make something? What are the unsaid aspects of what an inhabitation suggests? Or city suggests? What kinds of other feelings are there that are not easily discernible? And so that's part of what I was also working with in this, which I am still working with in this work.
Well, I have more questions, but I bet I wonder if anyone in the audience has thoughts or questions too about what we've been looking at. Sydney.
Thank you very much. A really wonderful presentation. I'm curious, because you are such a prolific writer and there are so many layers to your pieces, how you feel about the art historian, the person who comes in and interprets or analyzes the work and how you feel yourself in relation to that figure, like James.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very good question. Oh, okay. The question, and you can correct me if I'm not getting this right. The question, as I understand it, is how do I relate to or feel about or think in relation to the art historian? Me being someone who's using words and writing, as you mentioned, prolifically, but what's my relationship to an art historian and my work? And I mean, what I think is that I'm open, and I think I wanted to mention this about James actually as an art historian. One of the things that I really respect is the scholarly approach that's possible for an art historian to actually probe deeply, and also there's another perspective that would not be mine, but yet I don't accept that what I'm writing, thinking, or describing is less important. I think it's a different register, and it would be impossible for me ever to historicize myself in the way that an art historian would do that. And it took me a really long time to kind of understand more about that, because I was really resistant. And you will read, if you read this book, there's a text in there, or there's some reference to an art historian who I studied with, John Paoletti. And I remember when I was a student, I was resisting this. I was saying, well, you know, it seems as if, artists are stupid, and it's not as if we could ever possibly understand anything about what we're doing. because he was saying there's an impossibility there. But I didn't interpret the impossibility at that time as being something related to the distance and the, a different perspective that would always be elusive for anyone in their own moment, and also in relationship to themselves. I thought of it as something, you know, he was saying something more about like capacity or ability or something like that. Whereas I think in like reading something like a George Kubler book, The Shape of Time, for example, that's a really interesting indication of a certain impossibility, the constant missing that occurs in terms of trying to understand anything at the moment in which it's emerging. So, James, what do you think? I have a lot of thoughts about it, because the thing is that James, I think of the kind of art historian you are as a very special kind. I think my ideal kind of art historian is a more scholarly kind, not kind of like totally fast and loose with it. I'm really interested in that difference, if there can be a difference. I mean, I consider myself also to be scholarly in terms of my investigations and what I'm doing, yet I'm not a scholar. I'm an artist. And I like that difference. Mm. I like whatever that might mean, how that might be interpreted. Mm.
A really good example, Sydney, would, I don't know, could we put up Partially Buried? It's a work that's meant a lot to me by Renee, and it's about Robert Smithson, and who, as many of you know, was this important land artist, and who made a work, a woodshed that he dumped with dirt at Kent State University 4 months before the riot. And Renee did this work, Partially Buried, and this is just part one. It has three parts, which is an archaeology of that project of Smithson, of Kent State, of the riot. There's images of the riot. Different books, including Kent State by James Michener, his most famous account of the protest. A piece of the woodshed on that table, if we could go back, That's Renee took that from the foundation of the partially buried woodshed.
She's actually given it by a journalist.
Okay.
I didn't really want to take anything, but it was like handed to me.
Yeah. And that's a map of Kent State, including the gym annex, which we could talk about. But basically, it is, in a sense, a work of art history, but it's not. And it has an openness and a suggestiveness. Renee might say she's interested in metaphor that makes your work different from art history. So you're interested in associations.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't make really a really strict division about it. Although I guess part of what I see, what I interpret as part of the difference, and I think that in sometimes I am more of an art historian, but that would be with other people's work, and so maybe writing about someone else's work. I've taken on that function, or even thinking about art historians, I've also taken on that function maybe in a way. Yet it's informed by being a practitioner in a different sense. But I just think that these are other dimensions of what might be possible, because for the task of an art historian or an historian is not. It is also an inventive one. It's a process of invention that's taking place at the same time as a scholarship is taking place, because you've got to create a believable narrative. And so that's kind of where there is an intersection.
Yes, there's something similar.
But there's a different kind of ethical. I mean, there's a different ethics of what you're responsible for, I think. I mean, I'm basing this on conversations with others who are art historians. I don't know how you feel about that.
I think we've run out of time, but it's terrific that you've come, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.